Welcome to More Than a Refresh, a podcast about data and the people who wrangle it. This episode is a bonus recording featuring one of my favorite guests, Corinne Chambers, a surgical oncologist in El Paso, Texas, who focuses on saving the boobies. For some background on this episode, you can listen to episode 3 of the show, where Corinne Chambers introduced herself to our community. Our recording studio today is located in Lake Wenatchee, Washington. Corinne, how did a fifth-generation cattle rancher in California get to be in theater in New York?
Well, so my high school theater program was actually run by a PhD in theater out of UC Santa Barbara, which is also now my alma mater. And so I developed a real big love of theater throughout high school, and I majored in theater as in college as well. So I just never lost that love. So my medical school career took me to Brooklyn, New York, via the Caribbean. So of course, when I was in Brooklyn, New York, in the five boroughs, I obviously spent some time experiencing all New York had to offer, including Broadway.
Via the Caribbean?
Oh, yes.
Was this a last moment dalliance or a vacation or...
So I'm actually a St. George's Medical School graduate, which is the medical school out of Grenada in the West Indies, where they went to rescue the students in the late 70s, early 80s. I went to school there. So they have a year and a half of coursework based on the basic sciences out of the Caribbean.
Wow. Interesting. Okay. Yes. Well, when you think of the Caribbean, you think of, you know, beaches and resorts and, you know, scantily clad people. And it's just, a place you go to decompress. What is it? We know that's not a party school. So what is it like to, you know, be in that environment through your education?
So what's unique about that medical school and that setting in particular is that there were a bunch of graduates of college across the United States attending medical school there. So the island of Grenada, where we were at, was basically the campus and some outlying apartment complexes. So we were basically with our fellow students for those years and a half. And we worked hard, but we played hard also. It was a good experience. And I think that one of the kind of unforeseen benefits of that is what we were all away from all our distractions that we would have at home. So we were able to focus in a different way because we were with a bunch of other people all trying to learn medicine.
Now I'm going to take a slight left turn here. And our producer, Lindsay, always loves when I do this, but you brought up an interesting idea. And I have a question for you.
Of course.
It clearly wasn't a gap year. You were working, you were moving forward to, you know, receive your degree and become a doctor. But do you think that perhaps we are applying too much pressure too soon to our children to push them straight, you know, 17, 18 years old, push them right into college, expecting them to be bona fide adults and sometimes entering the workforce with master's degrees before they even end adolescence? I mean, recent study shows that adolescence doesn't even end until about 25. And so we have a situation where we are forcibly molding our children with this cube of expectation, perhaps before they're ready for it.
I absolutely hear you and agree. And I've seen that on a few different levels because I also taught junior high for a couple years in between college and medical school and medical school and residency. And now I've come full 360. I am now teaching medical students and being their mentor in that perspective. So yes, I do think we put a lot of pressure on children at all levels of education and at all ages. And I think that that can be detrimental to getting that worldly experience that you need to order to be successful. So as someone who now also interviews medical students and potential candidates for surgical residency programs, I personally very much find it useful when you've had some more life experience and then have just gone straight through school from point A to point B, because it's, you need some of that maturity that comes along with those life experiences as well.
That's great. Where this came from is that I am reading a book. I'm not I apologize, I don't actually remember the title of the book, but it's about a lady who is now in her early 80s. But in the 80s, being the years, she was going through a divorce, unfortunately, and she kind of discovered herself. But mm-hmm. she was, I believe she was 39 at the time, or 47. She was in middle aged when she started to discover herself. And the way that she discovered herself was by going to Mexico. And then from Mexico, she went to Argentina, and she went to Peru, and she went to Honduras, and all these places. And one of the things that came up was that she kept running into these backpackers. Now, in America, backpacking is you go out into the woods, you get really dirty, you disappear from the world for a week or whatever, and then you come home.
Right.
These folks were generally, not always, but generally in their 20s, and they were out of school, or they were about to start school, one or the other, and they were taking time to explore and enjoy culture and see things that they will probably never see again. Mm-hmm. And it really kind of opened my eyes to how our culture, being the American culture, or I should say the United States culture, is that we've kind of become hyper-focused on production, and not just production of money or production of goods, but production of humans. And I'm not talking about in the Mormon sense, okay? I'm talking about production right. of humans in terms of get people into the workforce. You know, why isn't your kid in college? They're 20 years old. Mm-hmm. And it just, as I've kind of reflected on it, it brings about these ideas of maybe we need to slow down just a little bit and allow our children to actually be children, because 18 is a rather arbitrary age.
Agreed. No, I'm with you. And I see our, what we would call millennial generation kind of suffering for that and a little bit. And I think that we need to work towards developing whole human beings as opposed to just pushing everything towards academic achievement, because that doesn't mean everything.
Well, especially since in a lot of ways, academic achievement, as much as it is valuable, doesn't have a whole lot to do with what happens after the academic achievement, right? Mm-hmm. Just because you do really well in school doesn't mean you are going to do really well as a face-to-face oncologist, for example.
Absolutely not. I would favor an oncologist who was well-rounded and able to talk to me with some life experience, with some empathy and some compassion that was based in those experiences, as opposed to someone fresh out of school without that depth of knowledge.
I agree. Let's come back to the original topic here, but I think that this is something that we could explore further. Our last episode with a fantastic lady by the name of Stephanie Kermer, we had a similar discussion, but it was more around hiring practices and how hiring practices are very detrimental, because what will happen is you'll say, hey, let's be a data scientist and we want to hire a PhD. Well, what you've done by putting that term PhD on there is you've greatly reduced your talent pool. Mm-hmm. Because you're saying someone had to have gone to school and spent 100, 200 grand to come do this job. But when in reality, that is nowhere near the case. And you also are eliminating a large pool of opportunity for minorities, because a lot right. of they don't normally get PhDs, but that doesn't mean that they're not able to do the job, especially right. in the case of, say, a data scientist. Oncology is a totally different situation, of course. Okay, so let's get back to this. So we've gone from California, where you have all that lovely beef on a ranch, which we have just slaughtered half a happy cow, and it was the best hamburger I've ever had. And we went to the Caribbean, and we have experienced culture and, let's be honest, partying, but also true to life, pure involvement in education excellence. And now we have gone to theater. And we're in theater in New York, and we've enjoyed that culture in New York and everything that has to offer. How did you go from there to one of the smartest cities in Texas, El Paso, Texas, where you are an oncologist. And one of the reasons I say one of the smartest cities is that in the recent unfortunate winter storm that everybody was warned about, El Paso was one of the only cities that had power because they had their own power grid.
Exactly.
So how did we get there?
This circuitous route took me to Albany, New York for my residency training. And from there, when I got tired of the Albany winters, they were wonderful and beautiful, but I was tired of shoveling snow. I went and got my fellowship position in Charlotte, North Carolina. And so in Charlotte, North Carolina, I spent a couple years there, then did a couple years of private practice in High Point, North Carolina. And that's when I found this opportunity in El Paso, Texas, with Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. And this particular position allowed for a great blend of academic medicine, which meets community medicine. So I get to be a part of a practice that treats the indigenous population here, underserved, underrepresented minorities, while also having ties to the academic medical world and with clinical research and multi-institutional trials and all those things, at least available, if not readily present.
Interesting. I want to put a pin in that, because I'd like to talk to you about the indigenous population and how you treat them, because I imagine there's a couple of questions I have around there. But before we get to that, you know, beef, it's what's for dinner.
Absolutely.
So talk to me about beef, because there's a lot of bad press about beef right now. And I feel like, and in fact, there has been for a few years, you know, everything from the very true data that suggests that cattle are responsible for a not insignificant percentage of our greenhouse gases. That, I think, is an unfair perspective when you look at it holistically. I think that just like any place, any industry, you have good actors and you have bad actors. And I'll, you know, to use my own example recently, like I said, we just butchered half a cow. Well, this cow lived its life to the point where he became my delicious food, literally with many, many acres to just roam and eat and be a cow.
Exactly.
Be taken care of, checked up on, love. The cow had a great life. And I am a firm believer, and just for the record, our producer is a vegetarian. We are trying to cure her of this disease, but we have not found that cure yet. It was a happy cow, right? And you can tell by the quality of the beef, right? You can look at even, say, USDA Choice, which I believe is the highest grade. You can take some of that from your local store, and then you can just look at the beef that you just received from the butcher, and you can see a quality difference. And not to mention taste a quality difference. And so my question for you is, what is your perspective on, you know, any mature adult knows there's good actors and bad actors, and there's certainly a way that we can continue to enjoy our beef. But what is it, on your ranch, what is it that you do to make sure that you're a good actor?
So like you describe, our cattle are free range cattle with lots of acreage to spread themselves out upon and lots of feed to support them. And if the grass is dry in the dry seasons of the year, then we feed them. So we take care of them, we check on them, we move them from pasture to pasture when they need new feed. So I think that there's a big difference between free-range cattle and cattle that are raised in feedlots. And I have some difficulties with a feedlot type situation because there's just not enough space for these cattle to be content or happy or to grow properly. So I'm with you. I think that the more free-range your animals can be, the better for them. And then it feels less awful consuming them.
So that's a good point. And I'm glad, because I did not know what kind of ranch you ran before I asked the question. I was hoping that the answer would not turn into a contentious debate. But one, I agree with you with feedlots. I've been to feedlots, and, you know, personally, I think they're inhumane. And even more so, I have to ask myself, you know, what do I allow my children to eat? Right? Would I allow my children to eat a pound of Skittles for dinner? I would never do that. It's, you know, it's supposed to be a treat, right? Well, it is known, it's been published, that leftover candy that is not of quote unquote consumer grade, they will give it to feedlot cows to help beef up the cows more quickly. And there's other things, right? They'll feed them corn. Well, cows don't naturally eat corn. So there's some concerns there. And don't get me wrong, I don't want to beat on feedlots too much, because I think that there's also a consideration that the demand for beef is such that if you're going to keep prices at something that's at somewhere where most people can afford, you do have to make some sacrifices. And those sacrifices can be in quality. They can be in humane treatment. They can be in diet, because certainly, as we've known in the marketplace, getting, you know, highly processed food is very cheap, whereas getting not highly processed food is more expensive. So I do think, you know, to be fair, we have to take that into consideration. But on the other hand, you have to wonder if we, instead of the mass production, right, where we're delivering more beef than we do anything else, right, in terms of food, perhaps it's time to diversify the ecosystem of how people get their proteins.
Sure. Because I don't disagree at all. It's more about cost and supply and demand, because our cattle ranch runs maybe a couple hundred head of cattle, but we're not a big money maker, right? In order to actually make money and profit, you need to kind of compromise with the amount of space that you use to raise these cattle, with how many cattle you actually need to raise to be productive. So I'm with you there. And I mean, there's chicken, there's lamb, there's pork. I mean, we can diversify. We don't all have to eat beef all the time, because that's not healthy by all means.
Well, let's not forget crickets.
Why not?
And before anybody just absolutely thinks I'm nuts, cricket protein is actually a thing because of how easy they are to turn into food, essentially.
Cricket, but flour, one of my favorite all kinds of things.
Yeah, cricket energy bars, the whole bit. One of my favorite lines from a TV show, Yellowstone. It's a very popular TV show for a lot of folks. I mean, Kevin Costner is speaking to the Cattle Association in Montana. And he says, you know, this is one of the few, or it's the only business where we strive to break even.
Right.
And a lot of people don't understand that, is that as expensive as beef is, there's very few companies that are really raking in the dough and paying the CEOs billions of dollars a year to raise cattle. If any, I honestly don't know. You know, I have a note here, and the note says, any beefy data, and I don't think, and when I ask this question, is there something interesting about raising beef? I mean, I don't think that a lot of people understand what it really takes to raise a happy, healthy cow. And I'll give you an example. How much average space per cow does it take for you to have a happy, healthy cow from the point that it is born to the point that it becomes delicious food?
I'm thinking about that for a second, but to further on that question, cattle need care. They need to have feed. They need to have water. They need to have vaccines. They need to have treatment for illnesses, just like anyone else does. Sometimes they need help with birthing, et cetera. But as far as exactly how much space may need to be needed to raise cattle, I would say a few hundred acres for not necessarily a cow, but maybe a cow family. there needs to be enough space that they can graze that land and then move on to some others once that land has been grazed. And if not, you need to have another pasture to move them to, if that makes sense.
So you say a couple hundred acres for a family. Now, what in cow world, what's a family? Because it's not a nuclear family. We're not talking about 2.1, right?
No. And sometimes you have to keep the bulls separate from the rest of the herd until, you know, you're ready to start the calving season. Well, let me just say this. We run a couple hundred cattle on a little over 3,000 acres. And that seems to be about right for our ranch escapades.
Wow. So that number is vastly larger than I expected. I was expecting something more along the lines of a cow to 5 acres kind of thing. But then again, you know, I can see your point. When cows aren't exactly known for their athleticism, so you know, they're going to get it their exercise through grazing, essentially, as they move and eat and move and eat.
And if they graze over that whole part of land to it's down to the ground, then they need to be able to move to another spot of land.
So you mentioned things like, and I'm going to roll past this here in a moment because I really would like to get more into the medical stuff. But this is an interesting topic for a lot of people because they just, you know, most people, I posted a picture of the hamburger we made from our happy cow. And one of the people that came back said, happy cows come from Safeway. And I'm like, no, that is not actually true, but thank you for playing. You have just lost Jeopardy. So you did mention something that's important, though, is that just like we take care of our families, calves or cows, you know, they have a life cycle. They are born, and often you might need to help them be born. And when we say help, that means somebody might be putting on a really big glove and exactly. reaching into a really dark cave and pulling out a calf.
Yes.
So next time you guys have a burger, keep in mind that these cows, they're not machine processed, right? They're living beings that when properly taken care of and shepherded in the proper way, provide a great resource to our civilization that is absolutely delicious.
If I might digress with one more story that you might find amusing. The one time that I have physically butchered a cow myself with my family was about a 1,500 pound heifer. So mama cow who just had a calf, but she ended up being sick and bleeding during the birthing process, and we lost the calf and we were going to lose the heifer. So in order to utilize all that properly, we did decide just to butcher her ourselves and utilize that meat. So once you've done something like that, your appreciation for meat of any sort takes on a whole new level.
I absolutely agree. I lived in a little town called White Salmon, Washington, about a decade ago, and there was a family that they had about 150 acres, and they would raise about, I don't know, a couple of dozen cows on this. And of course, they didn't have enough. We're in the Pacific Northwest, so there was trees everywhere, so there was a lot of purchased hay, right? Or you know, instead of necessarily grazing, but other than that, they were free range, and they thought it would be funny to ask the city boy who moved to the country to help them with the insemination process.
Oh,
that, I think I still talk to my therapist about that day. It was definitely an experience. Okay. So moving on from beef, let's talk a little bit about the professional Corinne Chambers and some of the problems that we encountered in our discussion last time, and maybe we won't solve them, but we will still open the eyes further of our listeners and maybe help move a solution down the path. You said last time that everything that you do and everything you practice has a backbone of research behind it. And it takes years and years of clinical data to be able to create a practice that is up to the highest levels and standards of care. Mm-hmm. What goes into creating this backbone of research, and how is that data tracked throughout the research process?
So, for example, when I was stating those facts, I was describing big multi-institutional, multi-center studies that ran and decades ago through that changed our practice patterns and developed new ways to treat breast cancer. And then the next decade or two brings on the next big development or wave in breast cancer treatment or cancer treatment altogether. So oncology, surgery, medicine is, it moves in decades as far as progression based on research, based on data, based on clinical trials, based on outcomes, and 5, 10 year, 15 year, 20 year follow-ups.
Okay, so we're really talking about, and I'm going to assume this is cancer in general, but what we're talking about here is a lifetime of care.
Yes.
And we're talking about a lifetime of research. So for any individual, you know, you see the movies, right, where someone gets diagnosed with cancer, hopefully at the end of the movie they have not passed on to whatever afterlife they believe in. But through, you know, it's, they go through the battles, the curtails, the chemotherapy, the vomiting, the weight loss, the hair loss, the challenges to the personal relationship and all those things. But then they go into remission and everything is great. But that's not what we're really talking about here, is it? I mean, we're talking about, sure, you're in remission, but you are still checked. How often are we checked and recorded and scanned and all that stuff?
So for breast cancer specifically, because most cancers have different recommendations based on risk of recurrence, et cetera. But for breast cancer specifically, during the first year, you need to be seen every 3-4 months or so, and about the same for year two. And then you can start stretching it out. But for me, once in my practice, once you've gotten through your active treatments, so maybe 6 months down the road, maybe a year down the road, then I start seeing you yearly after your yearly mammograms to make sure that there's no abnormalities or no new problems developing.
Oh, and that's actually a good point. We talked about this on the last episode that we did together. You mentioned mammograms, and a lot of people, when they think of breast cancer, immediately think that, you know, a woman is going to lose her breasts. And one of the things that you specialize in is non-removal, correct? Treatment through, by literally saving the boobies.
So there is, you know, there's breast conservation therapy or breast removal. They're both good options for chance of cure. We do talk about surgery for curing breast cancer. I mean, most cancers need to be removed before you can say you're completely cured and in remission. Some cancers, like blood cancers, don't, but for organ tumors or for soft tissue tumors, then removal is usually the curative step there. But there are surgical options, including just removing the lump that's involved or just removing the breast, while we look at the lymph nodes as a sign of chances of spread through the lymph nodes of the axilla to other parts of the body.
Okay. So we have a lifetime of tracking, and we've kind of established the grade of tracking, right? How often we see people. How do we store this data, and how do we correlate it without adversely affecting the, you know, the PII, the personal information that you store for these people? Because I mean, that's what research is, right? You have lots and lots of data that you then correlate and figure out whatever is the answer to the question you're asking of this data. How do we do that?
Well, and that exactly is the rub, really, because most of these data sets are developed from principal investigators or primary investigators of this research who track that themselves with their research team, not necessarily something we just have databases housing this data beyond individual studies and individual groups of running those studies.
Okay.
And national databases that have some of that.
So what are these entities, these institutes, are these private corporations? Are they nonprofits? Are they both? Are they, you know, why aren't they sharing?
No, meaning, for example, I would be the primary investigator on the studies that I'm running, and I would be controlling that data with the help of the people working with me on that study. Though there are national databases that we participate in. For example, I use the Mastery of Breast Surgery database. So every case that I do, I enter the information about that particular case, and the American Society of Breast Surgeons kind of regulates that data. But there's a process to be able to access that you have to go through. Otherwise, you're talking about a small institution, small research groups, or multi-institutional groups gathering the data however it needs to be gathered and working through it and analyzing with the help of statisticians and other research team members.
So we don't have, and I'm not trying to beat a dead horse, I'm just trying to be clear. We don't, you know, because you said there's the National Cancer Database. But we don't have, like, say, data democratization in this, where anyone, obviously anonymized, but anyone can look up anonymized cancer data in general, right? Now, obviously, there might be some out there that's been made available. But we don't have a database where, you know, some savant in a basement decides to cure cancer and starts combing through the data. Now, whether or not they do or not is obviously irrelevant, but there's no easy access to this, is what you're saying.
Not easy access. Even the Mastery of Breast Surgery database that I use, for example, I think it houses 1,500 other breast surgical oncologists and their data. And I'm trying to gather some data from that that's not just related to me and my surgical outcomes. And I have to fill out application forms. I have to talk and meet with the institution housing that data in order to be able to see if I can actually access it or not. So there's processes involved.
Is there normally a fee involved?
There is a fee involved.
Is it a reasonable fee?
Yeah, it's a small fee for this particular, but it's $50 for this particular database program that I'm trying to get access to. And a lot of the other databases, I think, are not charging fees, but this particular one does, which I thought was interesting too.
So keep in mind, a lot of people will say, oh my gosh, you know, how could they charge? Well, someone has to pay someone to maintain this data. And that's not right. Just the data itself. It's the computers, it's the staff, it's health insurance for the staff, it's all these things. So it does cost money. And I'm not necessarily suggesting that this information just be freely given to the world for the cause of humanity. But right. I do think there's definitely a problem in the visibility of the data to people in general. And this actually brings me to another slight, not a left-hand turn, but maybe a left at the Y, in that, are we sharing with, for example, India? Are we sharing with Europe? Are we sharing with Japan? Other democratic, centralized countries that are of similar footing in socioeconomic status, it seems like we could gain a lot of knowledge from each other with this research.
And we do share and collaborate. For example, at our international meetings, there's usually data from different countries being presented in those forums. So once a year, annual meetings that are internationally based, we get to convene and talk about the data coming from other nations as well. It's not necessarily like real-time data sharing like you might be imagining, but we do share that data.
So with what I brought up and what you brought up, do you think there's actually a problem, or do you have enough information to, let's say, adequately treat?
So on a day-to-day basis, I think I have enough access to treat with the highest level of care. My institutional research-related frustrations that are kind of across medical institutions is the resources and the availability of this data and the lack of a structured database where you can, once you've gone through the proper IRB approval channels, all that process, able to get that data and even create your own research projects.
Okay, so now we're starting to talk about things like the fact that within a single hospital, you can have multiple medical record systems.
It comes back to that slightly, but just the way that medical information is stored, even within one EMR, is challenging to access.
There's no standard. For the developers out there, there's no API to call to. It is, you know, whatever each vendor or database or whatever that people have created for this information, it's all implemented in a very different way between each other. And so, Corinne, when you go in to look for information in one system, you have to access it in one way. But if you go look for it in another system, you have to access it in another.
Well, not even that. Like if I open up my EMR and I want to find all the males I treated with breast cancer, I don't have a way to look and search and find that information.
You have no, wait, Sorry, you kind of threw me there. You don't have the ability to say, give me all males 25 to 35 that I have treated that have breast cancer.
No. I might if I go through my clinic manager to my clinic administrator to someone who knows the Cerner centricity system, the EMRs that I'm using, be able to try to find that data for me. But even just creating that list and asking for that can be a month before I get that information. I can't just go into the EMR and say search males with breast cancer from 2015 to 2017. There's no way I can do that.
So as a database consultant, specifically a PostgreSQL database consultant and explicitly an open source database consultant, I must say that is utterly absurd. It's like driving on the freeway without a seatbelt. It's insane that you have – in my world, I can literally give you the query, the language of the query – to get that data out of a normalized database, any database, Oracle, Postgres, DB2, it doesn't matter, MySQL, but no one in the right mind would do that. You know, I can do that, and I could probably do it blind in about 10 seconds.
Right.
It is crazy to me that you don't have the ability within your EMR system to say, search, here's my filters, go, and it doesn't come up all but instant.
Right. So I guess that what we have to do is translate it into CPT or ICD-10 codes. That's another step that we would have to take in order to find that, because all the information that we have is listed via those diagnostic codes. But it would be great, wouldn't it, if I could just open up an EMR and say search ultrasounds for a particular patient, and it brought up all the ultrasound results for that particular patient. We don't have a system that will even allow for that.
Now, we're Command Prompt's very familiar with the ICD codes. We actually helped spearhead a migration from ICD-9 to ICD-10 and wrote the application for the migration. It's in production today with a client. And what this client specializes in is creating a more human searchable and readable format for medical billing systems, basically. So you put in an ICD code and it comes up and it gives you a description that a layperson will understand. And then also searching, you can do things like search and say, well, for example, cancer. If you search for cancer, it's going to bring up all the ICD codes that are associated with cancer. Well, because databases are so good at what they're doing, there's no reason why you can't take that, those ICD codes, right? You, as the doctor, has said cancer, and behind the scenes, you say cancer male, and behind the scenes, it says, here's all the ICD codes for cancer. Here's all the males, cut, copy, paste, return result. And it should be that simple. I do not understand how something like that isn't available. And this reminds me, yesterday when we were recording, one of the things that I found out, I didn't know this, you might know this, when Apple Health first came out, which is their health application for, I guess it tracks calories in your diet, and how much exercise and all that stuff. When it first came out, they did not allow for menstrual tracking for women.
Huh.
How big of an oversight do you have to have? How big of a lack of understanding the problem you're actually solving do you have to not include a capability that affects every woman from the age of approximately 10 to approximately 50?
Right. That seems crazy.
Yeah. Now it does now because everybody said, Apple, what the hell? But this reminds me of the same problem, right? Is that who is writing these applications that cannot understand the value of being able to retrieve correlated and collaborated data for research in an easy manner?
Right. Well, I can maybe give you some more just real life problems and conundrums with some of the technology that we're facing. So for me, let's say I'm seeing a patient in the office and I have a bunch of scanned in documents from all their reports or the referral that got the patient to see me. Now all that is mixed in with every other document that's been scanned in about this patient for every other physician. So not even can I not search that information for research purposes, I can't even find an easy way to search for particular information on a particular patient unless I have to like go and categorize the way it's being displayed to me, et cetera, et cetera. But most of the time I just scroll through all the documents that are up there in the EMR until I find the ones that I need, because that's the most efficient way for me to do that.
So let's be clear for our listeners. Are we talking about just this EMR, or is this a problem across the board? I mean, you've obviously been a doctor.
Yeah. Yes, I think it's a general problem across the board, though some EMRs may do it a little better, a little differently than others.
Did you have a chance, when last we spoke, we talked about a project called Open EMR. Did you have a chance to review that?
Not fully, as much as I'd like. Eric, my significant other, and I kind of talked about that, looked into it a little bit, but my understanding is still so low on the technology and data programming side that I'm not sure I fully grasp everything that they're trying to do there.
You know, I think it's funny that you say that. You know, your skill set on the technology side is so low, and I'm like, you're a damn oncologist. How could you not know how to program a computer? And I say that as a joke, because you know, you'd be surprised. No, actually, you wouldn't be surprised. You're not. How? Let me ask you this: how often do people find out that you're a doctor and they say, "Well, I have this pain here," or something like that?
All the time, including my parents.
Yeah. And you're like, well, Dad, this is not, I'm not this kind of doctor.
I'm not, you know, orthopedic.
Have some CBD. Yeah, I'm not an orthopedic. Okay, so we're not going to. We discussed some of the problems with these EMRs, and we touched on one last time too. We're not going to solve that problem here, but what we have done, and I believe what we are doing is possibly opening up an opportunity to solve this problem. Because hopefully someone will listen to this that has a vested interest, that has some money, right? Because that's what it takes. Yeah. It takes money to make an application. And if you get someone who actually knows what they're doing in terms of user interface, in terms of database design, in terms of appropriate search capabilities, we're going to help not just cancer patients, all patients
right. In
the world. Right. And it kind of lends me to the idea of we really should look into this open EMR a bit, because it is open source. Yeah. And it is used internationally, and it might actually provide some of these capabilities. Unfortunately, I was not able to get that project to respond to my requests, but I am going to try again, because I think if we're not going to, and when I say we, I'm talking about a person, not necessarily you and I, are not going to develop a business plan and a prototype and then go to venture capitalists to build this thing. The next best thing is to see if we can get enough people interested in the open source solution that's already solving some of these problems and extend that, because it's available for free to the world.
Right.
And since we're talking about a human problem explicitly, I am perfectly fine that if there is a commercialized product out there that's not available in a certain part of the world when it's a luxury, you know, a TV, for example, and a lot of people are like, oh, TV is not a luxury. Yes, it is. You don't need a TV. Yeah. Read a book. I know, seriously. And this is said coming from someone who loves his 4K UHD HDR 10 65-inch TV. I love it, but my world is not going to end if it's gone.
Right.
But when it comes to solving the human problem, it needs to be available to everybody for a reasonable cost.
Right.
We can't, in that human problem, in this case, is oncology, but it could be anything, diabetes. You know, I remember the guy that was charging, what was it, you know, $1,000 a syringe for diabetes or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that type of stuff. It's just wrong, right? It's ethically, morally, and should be legally wrong. Okay. So let's move on a little bit. How do you feel, you know, we've actually touched on this, you know, the real goal here is we've got to educate software developers. But the problem with software developers is that those aren't really the people that we need to educate. We need to educate the UI, the user interface, user experience people. We need to educate the business people about the actual needs of doctors to adequately, and not even adequately, provide a high level of care to a patient.
Agreed.
Where do you think that starts? Do we get a bunch of doctors together at one of these? This is terrible, but I saw a movie once where a bunch of doctors go to a conference and they all drink too much and they're all hungover. But because they're doctors, they hook up the IV the next morning and they're only hungover for about 20 minutes, which is, I'm sure it's in some circles, there's some truth to that. But in reality, that's not, you know, normally what happens. But is that what happens? We go to a conference, do we present papers on this problem and bring about, you know, yourself and maybe a technical person and actually present the problem and, you know, an on paper solution? Is that a way to get the advocacy and energy efforts for people to actually think more deeply and try to deploy the solution?
I think that would be a great place to start, because even in some of the discussions that I've had with you or with my significant other, the problems that I see in day-to-day life are things that you know how to fix so quickly. And it seems so ridiculous that these connections haven't been made yet. So I think that, yeah, getting us all in the same room would be a good place to start. And yes, we all do get in the same room very often. And sometimes there is a little too much to drink, but I haven't seen anyone hook themselves up to IVs the next day, as best as I can tell.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, conferences, or I should say secular conferences. Secular conferences are about two things, networking and drinking. I mean,
exactly.
That's as far as I can tell, every single conference I've been to, and I have spoken at dozens, I've attended more than dozens. That's what it is. So what would be that conference? What is the conference that we can convince Corinne Chambers to step out of her bubble and work toward a solution for this problem, to become an advocate for doctors everywhere to provide a true and proper excellence in care through technology? I can't believe I just said that.
No, something that houses this technology meets medicine umbrella would be fantastic. And data management in medicine and utilizing the electronic medical record and how best to do that effectively. Because one of the other issues, I think we may have hit on this, but just to reiterate and maybe make that clear, is that the way our information is placed into our medical record systems, it comes in multiple different modalities. It can be in a free text note, it can be in a scanned in PDF, it could be in an actual progress note or office note from any particular healthcare practitioner. So trying to find isolated bits of data within all those different pieces is very challenging sometimes.
Definitely. And since we're talking about a lifetime of care, that means a lifetime of data. And,
right,
you know, you and I are old enough to remember, you know, scans that are terrible. Right.
Yes.
Nowadays, if you scan something, even on your phone, if you just use your phone to take a picture, you can do OCR and it's accurate to an nth degree. Occasionally there's a mistake, but we can have data entry specialists correct those. But the reality is that we should be able to take all these old scans, run them against OCRs. And if we can't run them against OCRs, then what you have is a situation where you have to have a human input that, you know, whatever that PDF is by hand, which slows the process down. But from the day of deployment forward, there's no reason why we can't have a situation where every PDF that is scanned, every medical file that's sent in, even if it comes through facsimile, I mean, people still use fax machines, especially doctors.
All the time.
Yeah. So there's, you know, my company has a fax. It's the same fax that we have had the year 2000, and it's not a machine. It's not a machine, isn't a mechanical machine. It's a computer. When you fax us, it comes to me as a TIFF document now, or okay. It used to. Now it comes as a PDF. But because of that, you can have a situation where we can remove these fax machines, keep the technology, but you plug it into the primary collector, whatever that is. Fax comes in, it's processed, it's OCR'd, it's submitted into a queue. If it can identify exactly based on certain key components and variables where it belongs, it will just put it in there, and then it goes into a queue where someone actually validates it. But if it doesn't know what to do with it, it just goes into another queue, and then that person validates it, maybe enters it in and attaches the physical, or the, I shouldn't say physical, the digital file to the record. All of that is, none of that is difficult. It just isn't. I mean, I wrote a system at one point, and this was 15 years ago, where anytime you hit print, okay, anytime you hit print, instead of going to a printer, it would create a PDF, take that PDF based on the information in the actual URL. For those who don't know, the URL is the web address. This was a web application. Be based on that and the variables passed, we would actually know exactly what we were printing and who it belonged to. So you could hit print, it would hit the disk, a job would come along, grab that file, insert it into PostgreSQL, and correctly associate it with the client. And why this matters, I'm not tooting my own horn here, this matters because it was for an insurance company.
Oh, sure.
Right.
I mean, that sounds like it has lots of applications in the medical world for sure.
Right. And that's what I'm saying is that, you know, a lot of people that will be listening to us might say to themselves, man, this sounds really complicated. For the people that know how to do it, it's not. It's just another job. We can get it done. We need someone to pay for it.
Right.
But other than that, you have not listed a single thing in these problems that we are trying to solve that is technologically impossible, technologically difficult, or technologically improbable. In fact, everything that you have listed is stuff that everybody who is doing development today is doing every day, just in a different industry.
Right.
So for me, my question is, we have these ideas. I mean, I'm not in the medical field. What do you think the next step is? Because we're obviously, you know, illuminating these problems to the world. We are going to talk about it. I assume you're going to talk to your colleagues and they're going to listen to the podcast and we're all going to think about it. But I would hate to have this be one of those, you know, they had some really great ideas. Let's go buy something from Amazon.
Right.
I want it to be something that has a substantial benefit, even if it's 10 years from now. How do we get people moving in that direction?
We need a group, like you say, that can help bridge the interface between what the physicians see and do on a daily basis with what the technology is capable of doing and find a way that meets those two. But you're not wrong in that this all requires money too. So that may be one of the hindering factors here. But I think starting to get these people in a room and starting these discussions is a great place to start.
Okay, so money may be a limiting factor, and I'm just going to call it for what it is. Oncologists make bank. Okay. And that's not the only specialty that makes a lot of money. But I mean, if you're a specialist, you're generally speaking, you're probably doing enough to where if we could get, let's say, 25, 50, 100 doctors to donate to, let's make it a nonprofit, donate to a nonprofit that is specifically building this solution. It seems like we could fund it pretty quickly. Now, of course, we need the visibility for the doctors to care, but does that seem unreasonable?
I don't think that seems unreasonable, but to actually develop these interfaces and actually start using it, maybe that's where, I mean, the money will come into it. The meeting and getting the people involved primarily, I don't think is going to be a big problem, but actually putting these ideas into action, don't you think there may be some more issues there?
Well, definitely if we start getting into, and I've been on the board of a couple of nonprofits, and one of the things about nonprofits, and this is true of a company too, but, or I should say a for-profit company, but the difference here is this, a nonprofit generally has ideological purpose. And because of the ideology, if one person or two or nobody agrees on the ideological purpose, even regardless of the mission statement, you end up with deadlock. Whereas with a for-profit company, the net result is the same. You must make profit. So there's always a direction, whether or not it's people going in 70 different directions, eventually those 70 different directions will converge, or multiple directions will just fall off for the interest of making profit. When you're talking about a nonprofit, it's not the interest of profit, it's the interest of the public good. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have a lot of different opinions about what the public good is. And even for those who agree, they may not agree on how.
Right.
So in my mind, this would have to be, one, we'd want to solve a single problem first. Mm-hmm. And the one that makes the most sense to me is, let's build a simple application that takes an existing data set and allows you to do that search.
Okay.
Just show how beautiful and simple it can actually be. That is the single problem to solve, is I open this application and I can search by gender, I can search by age, I can search by meta diagnosis. And when I say meta, cancer is a meta diagnosis, right? Because I could have skin cancer and it may not even matter, or it could be a really big deal. But you can just search for those parameters and it will return not only a data set that says these are the people that meet your parameters, but possibly as a feature set of it, it actually does a little bit of intrinsic analysis of the data and brings up some suggested pain points. And a suggested pain point would be, for example, when you go to Amazon and you search for something, and it may bring back the exact thing, like it terrifies you because you didn't even know exactly what you were searching for. And somehow Amazon knew exactly what you were searching
right.
for. Okay. Yes. But it also brings back a list of things that says you may also be interested in.
Right.
And that's done through that intrinsic, you know, correlation, forensic type thing. If we solve that one problem, and I'm not going to lie to you, that's not a small problem,
right?
But it is a simple problem. If we solve that one thing, and I'm not exactly sure how much that would cost, I would, you and I would have to have some offline about like a project like that, what it really means and what kind of data we're going to receive and all that type of stuff. But if we could get that one problem and then we go to one of these conferences and we say, hey, look, here's the one problem we solved. Here's the 100 we want to.
Right. That would be there fantastic.
It doesn't even have to be. I mean, I'm not even suggesting it's me. When I say we, I'm talking about some group of people to do this thing. So listeners, if you are interested in this, and when you consider, you know, Corinne, what is the statistic? How many women get breast cancer?
1 in 8.
1 in 8 women get breast cancer, and men?
But 1% of all breast cancers are men.
Okay, 1% of all breast cancers are men. Now, a lot of people are like, oh, that's not that much. There are 190 million men in the United States. Now do 1%. Okay, it's not an insignificant number, and certainly the 1 in 8 for women is much larger. So to our listeners, talk to us, reach out to us. I know Corinne, she is honest about this. She is sincere about this. This is a problem that has, you know, bothered her since the beginning, that has not been solved. And I know that our listeners are some of the most technologically capable people in the world. We can solve this problem and do it right. We can solve it correctly. And that means with a proper business plan. That means with proper funding. That means where people are getting paid. They don't have to work 90 hours a week, where the human condition is taken care of while doing good. And we can succeed through our good works.
Yeah.
All right, Corinne, is there anything else that you would like to add with this?
No, I think that's fantastic. I think just even having the discussions about where these discrepancies are and what we need in the day-to-day running of things and what we what we could be so capable of with a little more bridging of this gap that I see.
Okay, I agree with you. And I think that with the right team, whomever that team may be, and I'm hoping that people will reach out. We're not hard to find, commandprop.com, click contact, happy to speak with you. And then I'll speak with Corinne and let's see what we can make happen. This has been more than a refresh. This is a bonus episode. It has been awesome speaking with you again, Corinne, and I hope to have you on in the future where we can talk about how we are actually moving forward with something.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
This podcast is hosted by JD, Command Prompt founder and Postgres conference chair, and is produced by me, Lindsay Hooper, director of events at Command Prompt, Inc. Command Prompt provides Postgres support, professional services, custom development, and community leadership. Since 1997, we've focused on providing just excellent service, custom tailored to your organization's needs. We'll see you soon, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.